Good morning. When Colleen Hanabusa took over as chair of HART, she promised answers and better oversight. With rail the linchpin issue in the Honolulu mayoral race, many are wondering what will happen when she's very likely to be elected to Congress. We'll talk with her later this hour. And with new FDA regulations of e-cigarettes and vape products, vape or business owners are worried about their futures. We'll talk with one who says they're going to push to amend the rules. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. For some, the paperless future is already here. St. Francis Head of School, Sister Joan of Arc Souza, is with us to tell why.
It's Friday, August 12th. That's The Conversation. First, this news. Yeah, there's a lot of neck, sort of rubbernecking in here, doing that, enjoying that a little bit going into this Friday. Hope you enjoy that too, and that you've got a good weekend in store. Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and this is The Conversation. To my right, as always, Mr. Bluesman himself,
good morning, my favorite guy, at least.
Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
You know, since the e-cigarette phenomenon came along, it sort of outpaced the ability of law to regulate it. Now it's sort of caught up. Is that the way it seems?
Well, in one perspective, yes. From one perspective, maybe not from those who are involved with e-cigs. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about that as our first conversation this morning. Now, this week, rules to regulate e-cigarettes and vaping products went into effect. And for the retailers who sell those products, it could mean fewer vape shops in future. The Food and Drug Administration will now have to approve all e-cigarette and vaping products on the market since 2007. That means they're going to have to submit them to the FDA before they can be sold. The manufacturers will have 2 years to make that happen, so shelves will stay stocked in the interim. Buyers will also have to show ID to prove that they're over 18. Those are just a few of the rules that have vape shop owners concerned for their businesses. Corey Smith is the co-owner of Volcano E-Cigs. We sat down to talk about what he and other vape business owners across the nation will do to push for change.
The first thing that needs to change in our minds is the predicate date. The rule and all of the regulations that go along with the rules puts our industry under much more scrutiny than tobacco cigarettes. The predicate date is the date at which the FDA looks at existing tobacco products and says, well, anything after this date is grandfathered in.
That's 2007.
Correct. So right now, there's no added extra scrutiny for tobacco cigarettes that were on the market. The problem with the way these regulations have been put forth is there were no electronic cigarettes or vapor products that were really on the market before the predicate date. And so at this time, basically any product that was introduced in our specific product category is more or less going to be effectively banned or removed from the market.
Which would put a big crimp in your business.
Correct.
At this point, because the FDA is saying that they're trying to prevent death and disease and they're concerned about all of the chemicals that go into the vape smoke and the fact that you have people exposed to it in a secondhand way, in a similar way that people are exposed to cigarette smoke in a secondhand way, is there any point at which you would agree with them that that is a concern?
I think it's a concern. I mean, I think there needs to be some level-headedness. I mean, if you take a look at the vast majority of science that is out there, in fact, the Royal College of Physicians out of the UK came out and stated that their research shows that electronic cigarettes are about 95% less toxic than tobacco cigarettes. So here the FDA has put together this package of regulations that is going to overtly scrutinize the product, remove access to the market, remove products that, you know, have been shown to be less toxic than traditional cigarettes, and yet leave all of these products, such as tobacco cigarettes, which are known to kill 400,000 people a year, let's leave those products on the market. You know, to me, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense in terms of public health.
Obviously, you have your business and your concerns at heart with all of this. and you feel that you're being really put upon by the FDA to have to comply with something that you don't see as being dangerous. They do. We saw that kind of thing play out years and years ago, decades ago, where you had cigarette manufacturers and the government at odds with each other for quite a while. Then there was a master tobacco settlement. Then there's been a lot of activity directed toward education and removal of cigarettes from, you know, the easy reach of kids. Lots of things have happened in there. As you look at your industry now, the vape industry, the fact that you've got flavors and it's, you know, somewhat colorfully packaged, got sort of a cool factor that has been developed around it, how do you reconcile all those things with the fact that we don't really, you know, want people to smoke because it's costly and because it's not good for health?
I think there's got to be some common sense. We're all for common sense regulations. I mean, to sit here and say that we don't want any type of regulations, that we don't want any type of quality controls, that we don't want to have the best possible products on the market and remove products that shouldn't be there. We're not going to sit here and say that we want the wild, wild west, but there needs to be some level-headed clearness that needs to go along with the regulations that, you know, do get put upon our industry.
So what does that look like to you?
To me, it's all about quality control, so making sure that products are being manufactured to a specific quality assurance level, making sure that there aren't specific ingredients within e-liquids, or making sure that, you know, they're within specific tolerances, making sure that there's child-proof packaging, making sure that the industry is following specific guidelines in terms of the marketing the specific products. But again, I will come back to, you know, I'm of the belief that people need access to as many products that help them get off of cigarettes. I think removing access to products that help people transition away from tobacco is actually going to have the reverse effect. If you take away access to products that people use to get off of tobacco addiction, they're going to most likely fall back into tobacco addiction. So,
but what about the fact that there's nicotine in the, you know, the e-liquids, and those are the things that people are addicted to?
Well, this is the main difference between our product and pretty much any other product that you can find on the market. You can't smoke a zero nicotine cigarette. It doesn't exist. But you can vape e-liquid that has zero nicotine in it. And it does give the user the ability to control the amount of nicotine that they're ingesting. I can ingest a 16-milligram e-liquid. I could ingest an 8-milligram e-liquid. I could choose to ingest a 0-milligram e-liquid. There are no other types of products on the market currently that gives the ability to users for them to control that. And that's one of the big differences between our product and traditional tobacco products.
There's also been a lot of the conversation that, in fact, the e-liquid and vaping ability of someone to use it in transition doesn't, in fact, make a transition. It just simply transitions them to another addiction. How do you answer that?
I can't sit here and say that my product helps people quit smoking. The FDA specifically says that I'm not allowed to say that. But I think anecdotally, if you go online and you search, you'll find story after story after story of people who have used the products to do that. I personally know several people in my own family who have used my product to get off of tobacco and to quit vaping altogether. I mean, our business hasn't grown in the last 3 years. It's actually shrunk. And we attribute a lot of that to the fact that our people have used our products to quit smoking and to quit vaping altogether. So I can't legally go out and market my product and say, hey, use this product to quit smoking. But anecdotally, I can tell you that you know, I personally have received hundreds of phone calls, thousands of emails of people who have thanked me for that. And you know, it's a shame that I'm not allowed to say that because that's the FDA's stance on it. But I think it boils down to, you know, the money. That's what it really always boils down to, is the money. When you look at the regulations and what they're doing, they're really protecting the tobacco market and they're protecting the pharmaceutical markets. We're the first innovation in terms of smoking ever. And we've created a big threat to large moneyed organizations such as Big Pharma and Big Tobacco. And I think there's a lot of misinformation and there's a lot of lying going on trying to paint our specific industry under a certain light. And I think if you do enough digging and you take a look underneath the hood, there's a lot of other great stories that exist there.
You just mentioned a couple things, though, about money. Mm-hmm. And also that your business has been decreasing in the last few years, according to you, because some of these products have been very successful for people in getting them off of tobacco and vaping altogether, which seems as if that might not be such a great business proposition for you. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at the next 5 years of all this, as people are made to comply with what the FDA has set down now, do you really feel that this is going to be a viable industry for you, or a viable way of being able to market this product?
I think, throughout history, people have always smoked. I mean, people have been smoking tobacco for thousands of years. Personally, I know people who don't necessarily want to quit smoking, but they understand the health consequences and what it's doing to their body over time. And I think that, there's a large segment of people who have switched to vaping, and some people switch and say, hey, well, I'm going to try and use this as a method or a means for me to try to quit smoking and vaping altogether. And some people just say, hey, I would like to switch to this and continue vaping. Because vaping does provide a much different experience rather than smoking traditional tobacco cigarettes. So I think, until we as a society can say, hey, we no longer accept smoking and everybody's going to quit smoking, period, I think there will always be an industry for vaping, unless, of course, we're stamped out by, the powers that be. I think there will always be, a specific set of people who will gravitate towards that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Corey Smith co-founded Volcano eCigs in 2009. It started as an e-commerce business before the first ever brick-and-mortar vape shop opened in Kailua. It's now one of 12 Volcano shops in Hawaii, though that could change with the new FDA rules to regulate e-cigarettes and vape products.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:18 on the nose. And coming up in the show, St. Francis School takes a bold leap into the paperless future. But first, your quiz.
Ulana, o Mau, o Kaho'olawe, o Hawaii.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're remembering Hawaii's most ubiquitous crop's place in American history. It's not known exactly when sugarcane was brought to Hawaii by Polynesian explorers, but it was already a well-established crop when Captain Cook arrived. Early Hawaiians planted sugarcane in hedgerow-like structures around homes and property boundaries. However, it wasn't until the Great Mahele in 1848 that plantation-style industrial sugar production became feasible. With a redistribution of land, Westerners were able to acquire the large tracts required to create sugar plantations. Their principal export market was the United States, but demand for Hawaiian sugar was low due to an import tariff imposed by the U.S. government. That all changed with the outbreak of the American Civil War. Sugar production in the southern Confederate states was no longer accessible to the United States, which turned to the Kingdom of Hawaii to meet their need. A treaty was ratified by the U.S. Congress granting Hawaii duty-free exports to the U.S. market, and for today's quiz, we'd like to know the name of that treaty. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to get it right walks away with our T-shirt.
Support for today's programming comes from the BIA Remodel It Right Expo, featuring 3 days of seminars designed to help with home remodeling projects. 5 p.m. today through Sunday at the Blaisdell, biahawaii.org.
Today's students come of age or coming of age in a paperless world, so does it make sense to train them for that future? In a world of brick-and-mortar libraries with endless shelves filled with thousands upon thousands of bound volumes. Sister Joan of Arc Souza is the head of school at St. Francis School in Honolulu, and she's taken a bold step, replacing the school's traditional library with a digital media center. It's a decision that took some thought, and she's on hand to tell us about it. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in.
No problem.
As I was just said, this took some pondering before you did it. What were your thoughts going into making this decision?
Well, we did a lot of discussion with the librarian that we had and administration at St. Francis. Mm-hmm. We did get some resistance, but decided to move ahead because we felt this would be good for the students. So we began disassembling the library. Mm-hmm. Many of the books were sent to South America, Africa, books that hadn't been checked out in 10, 12 years. Mm. Students just weren't checking out novels and things of that sort. The first things that went were the reference books, because now 99.9% of that stuff is all on the Internet. Mm-hmm. The education went to the point of teaching the students where to find that information on the Internet.
Well, it's certainly a different landscape, and your kids, even the young kids, are computer adept now?
Yes, the tuition covers a Chromebook for each student in grades 4 through 8, mm-hmm. and then the high school students are expected to have their own laptops.
So when you see these young kids with the Chromebooks, how do they do them?
They love it. We just distributed them because we started school the first week of August, so the Chromebooks are ready to go out to to all of them, and the joy on the campus as these little fourth graders are walking around with their own Chromebook and all excited, learning how to use it, and they'll be using it in their math classes, science classes, all of their classes.
So you can do calculations. Can you look at videos, that kind of thing?
Yes, they can do it. The Chromebook can do just about anything a laptop can do. Especially at that age level, they're fine. They download any textbook we use that has an e-version. Mm-hmm. Students are encouraged to buy the e-version, download it onto their Chromebooks, so that it's saving their backs. They're not walking around with so many textbooks.
That was my thought. Yeah, it's got to make those backpacks a little lighter, right?
Much lighter.
Well, how many books did you have in the library? What was the task of dismantling the library?
Oh, we had several thousand books, I think, in the library, and we're still dismantling. We still have some books, and mm-hmm. we've offered them to teachers or students who wanted to just come in and take them, if they wanted to take them home. Otherwise, we find places in the foreign countries who welcome these books.
Sure.
We'll keep a few, some that have sentimental value. All of the racks are gone except for very few on the outside walls. Mm-hmm. The furniture in the library, what was the library, most of it is gone. We bought couches and soft chairs and carpets and tall tables with bar stool kinds of things. And when I walk in there and I see the students using all of this, I think the only thing missing is the Starbucks coffee.
Yeah.
It's become a student lounge.
Well, of course, the question any bibliophile would have is, are they reading as much under the new setup?
They are. They're reading. They have to do the reading because of their classes. Mm-hmm. The other thing we've done is in the English department at the high school, they no longer have that one giant literature book that, you know, for some of them it would cost $130, $150 for the literature book. So now they're just buying the novels that they're expected to read. So they're buying Romeo and Juliet, The Joy Luck Club, The Great Gatsby. These are the books that the students are expected to read for their English social studies classes. And if they can get them in digital form, fine.
Sure.
And they are reading it. When I walk in there and I see them with their laptops or their Chromebooks and I walk over to see what they're doing, they're doing the reading.
You know, one of the things I think for a lot of us at the high school experience, especially, was the creation of school publications, school paper, the yearbook.
Yes.
I know that was a big thing for me when I was a kid. What's the modern version of that?
We still have the school newspaper. It's called the Kealakai. It's been around since when I was a student there.
Uh-huh.
But now it's all digital. It's all online. It has been for about 4 or 5 years. We do one hard copy publication, which is referred to as the senior edition, in May. But other than that, all of the stories they write, everything is online, and all students have access to it.
Do you think you have a pretty good readership? As you get the impression that they're reading it, that they're reacting to it?
In many cases, depending on the topics, yes, mm-hmm. they do. And we also keep track of how many students are reading it. We can get that information, and they are.
Now, that's an interesting component of the whole electronic thing. You can tell who's reading the paper, huh?
How many hits it
yeah.
gets. We
oh,
have
sure.
whatever the program is that they use to determine how many people have actually logged on to it.
Well, that definitely is a feature of the digital world, isn't yeah. it?
Our yearbook is fantastic, the one that was just published at the end of this school year.
Yeah.
And it's interactive. So you download the app on your smartphone and hold it over the individual pictures, and the video of the entire event pops up, and you can watch it on your cell phone.
Which is really what the book of the future is going
yeah.
to be.
Yeah, and it's all done by the students under the direction of the teachers, so the students are learning how to do all of this.
You know, in the years that you were headed toward this decision, what were the indicators for you that moved you in this direction?
Just the whole digital world and how things were moving, the paradigm was changing. The books, students asking if they could pick up the e-book rather than the hard copy, and teachers saying yes. And so we just began to look at it and realize that more and more of their traditional textbooks were available as e-books, and it just started the conversation at the school to move in this direction.
And in a way, it sounds as if it was some largely driven by the younger generation, that they were picking up on this world so fast, yeah?
Oh, they're very quick with it. And sometimes a teacher will come by and say, well, I don't know how to do this, and my response usually is ask a kid.
Ask a kid,
yep.
Sure.
They know how.
Sure. Well, in creating something like a digital interactive yearbook, that takes a whole degree of tech savvy. How do your teachers adapt to that?
Well, we have a fantastic teacher who does the yearbook, Ryan, and he's very much into the tech world.
Mm-hmm.
And all of our announcements are all live, online, in the morning. The students are actually standing before a live camera under his direction, and school announcements are done live.
So, you mean they'll step up and address the camera and say the chess club is meeting Thursday? Or
that's right. Yeah. They open it with the a prayer, morning prayer, the Pledge of Allegiance, and then they go into all of the announcements. There's usually two that are co-anchoring it, and the students are learning how to produce all of this. And then later in the day, it's there so that if you've missed it, you can go back on. If the parents want to get in and see what the announcements were, once it's posted, they can go in and view the announcements, the morning news.
This has all got to be kind of exciting for you.
It is. And to see the students, and actually, you know, when they register for the class, it's one that fills up almost immediately.
Well, that does tell you where their interests lie, doesn't it?
It does.
Thank you so much for coming in.
It's oh, you're welcome.
Good to hear about that. Sister Joan of Arc Souza is the head of school at St. Francis School in Honolulu, and you can find out more about the school on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. Thank you.
Hawaii Public Radio selects and purchases programs from National Public Radio, American Public Media, and a host of other content providers. Our station members have followed the money trail, and they realize it starts and ends with them. Our thanks to these enlightened individuals, Chloe Hartwell of Honolulu, Sharon Fong of Kapolei, and Victoria Sims of Hilo. We'd like to add your name to the membership rolls. You can call us during business hours at 955-8821 to find out about sustaining your public radio station. And thanks. There are high-profile challengers to the Office of Hawaiian Affairs race. Could that mean longtime incumbents might lose their seats? Could be. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has an OHA reality check. Good morning.
Good morning and happy Friday, Beth Ann.
Yeah, you too. All right, so we've got four seats. This is looking a very interesting race for a number of reasons. First, let's talk about who's up.
Well, Haunania Poliona and Colette Machado, they have been on the board since 1996. Boy, 20 years now. Both of them are former chairs of the Board of Trustees at OHA, and both of them currently are chair and vice chair of a very important committee that handles land management assets. So they have not usually faced close re-elections, generally have been handily re-elected, but they are on the ballot again. So is Robert Lindsay Jr. He's the Big Island representative. He's currently the chair as well, and he's been on the board since 2007. And I should say there's another trustee from Kauai, Dan Ahuna, who's actually unopposed and therefore elected outright.
He gets to relax this time around. Yeah. But everybody else is not so much, given the fact that we've got some high-profile issues that are matching all of these incumbents and over the very long term that they've been serving. Let's talk about some of those for a moment. Well, obviously, we've been talking a lot about what has been happening with the TMT and with the indirect financial assistance for Naiopuni and other issues. Any of these you think that are more in the mind of voters than others?
Well, I think the thing that the challengers, we'll mention them in a moment, what they raised more than anything in their campaigns to be on OHA, to unseat the people that have been serving for a long time, is you need to have more transparency, more accountability. One candidate has even called for a financial audit. There's a concern that maybe things are not financially sound as they should be. Questions about investment decisions. That's something I hear over and over again from candidates. One person in particular, Mililani Trask, a longtime Native Hawaiian sovereigntist. She's been very active in criticizing OHA. By the way, a former OHA trustee herself, who ran for re-election not long ago, trying to get back on the board.
There's also Kili'i Akina from the Grassroots Institute of Hawaii. And there's been some talk that maybe these two are talking to each other.
Right. Ian Lynn had a column earlier this week and on how Trask and Akina have been talking. They actually have very different views on Hawaiian matters, but they do share a common concern about the direction of OHA. Akina, of course, as head of Grassroots, along with Judicial Watch, sued the Naiopuni process over their Native Hawaiian self-governance convention, specifically about holding an election. They said it was unconstitutional, and Akina still continues to criticize that process as well. Naiopuni indirectly supported by OHA money, frankly, for beneficiaries.
And one more thing before you leave that seems different about this particular race is that there's now a lot of talk about asking people who are not Hawaiian to make sure they vote in the OHA election. And for many non-Hawaiians, that was something they simply didn't do because they didn't feel that they were qualified.
In fact, the Supreme Court has upheld all Hawaii residents can vote in OHA elections. They are on the ballot Saturday, tomorrow, and they will be on the general as well. Kamanao Crabb, the CEO of OHA, says, if you care about the host culture, you really should vote for OHA candidates.
All right, we're going to leave it there and see what happens tomorrow. We'll talk to you on Monday. Bet we have lots to talk about.
I bet we do, too. Thanks, Beth Ann.
Have a good weekend. Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check. For News of Hawaii, we're going to take a preview of what we'll expect to hear from our news department come next week to help us with that, as always. News Director Bill Dorman is paying us a visit. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
On this primary eve.
Exactly. The week starts on the weekend this time around with that news, as you've been talking about, and from Town Square yesterday on through all week, the primary election day, finally tomorrow. And for one thing, tomorrow night on HPR2, by the way, we'll be maintaining the usual music, but we will also keep you posted on election results as we find out the information. Our own Mr. Nick will be live with Bridging the Gap, and he'll get some, we hope to get some early results on that program, just 6 to 8. Then as the evening goes on, we'll have some updates sprinkled into the music without being invasive about it, but just keep people posted. And then whatever happens, the beginning of next week, we'll have a bit of a reset one way or another. As you know, in terms of all the various races, the entire state house up for election, more than half the state Senate, mayoral races here in the Big Island, Honolulu City Council seats, county council seats across the state, other contests as well. And Wayne Yoshioka, our political reporter, will get a bit of a reset, and we'll figure out after the election where this all goes next.
That reset starting with the Unity Breakfast on Sunday.
As always, and that's always a fun sort of way to kick things off on tone and color and context and future directions.
Now, while we're talking about tone and color, for a lot of people who love Shakespeare, they have very definitive ideas of what that means. But now we're seeing something very different. What happens when you translate Shakespeare into another language?
Well, how's this? Not only another language, but a language I guarantee you've never heard, and that is the idea. Local Shakespeare enthusiast, fight scene coach Tony Pasquale has come up with a turn with Midsummer Night's Dream. Puts the play into two invented languages. So, you know, Noe Tanigawa had to go and check this out. And she says, think Game of Thrones without subtitles. But she also says that the play works. Puck and Oberon, the fairies, all talking in unfamiliar tones, but you can still follow the action of what's going on. And Tony maintains a key aspect of the work, which is the iambic pentameter. And so the rhythm of that, in terms of the language, has a way of carrying things along and wins the audience over, apparently. But Noe will have a lot more on that.
And certainly won't replace any of the Shakespeare that we grew up reading and loving, but good fun to see how this comes off.
Yeah.
And one more bit about the Hokulea, which now making sort of Homeward Bound.
Yeah, a bit of a twist. They've been heading up the East Coast from D.C. to New York all the way up to Maine. Now they've turned around and they're heading back down south. This week they bumped into something unusual for the crew, fog. For a couple of hours they couldn't even see the horizon, something they haven't seen all in their tours, but now they're headed south.
Something that simple, but, you know, sometimes that's the things that captivate us the most.
A little different.
Thanks, Bill. Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. This month, the Civil Beat poll of Oahu voters said they wanted the rail to go all the way to Ala Moana as originally planned. And while they certainly don't feel great about all of the cost overruns and likely additional costs in future, one of the things about rail that may have given some a more positive outlook was that former Congresswoman Colleen Hanabusa had taken over as chair of the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation Board just a few months ago. She brought a demanding attitude toward the questions surrounding the project, and now with her likely election to Congress, what will that mean for public confidence in HART's future? Colleen Hanabusa joins us now by phone. Good morning, and thanks very much for making the time.
No, thank you for always having us on and doing what you do, Beth Ann.
Thanks very much. Now, you said that you're doing all of this with HART, that originally when you came in April, because you felt that the board needed to be accountable to the public, and that's really trying to do the public's bidding in all of this. After all, the public is paying for it. So what about the public's trust in now the changing scene about HART are you exceedingly concerned about?
You know, I'm actually, I'm feeling a lot more confident, and let me tell you why. when the, both Civil Beat and the Star Advertiser did their recent polls that showed 60 and 62% of the people believe that the rail should go all the way to Ala Moana, you don't know how good that made me feel, because I think that's the highest percentage that we've ever had in terms of the public getting behind the project. And I think what worked was the board's concern about transparency and also letting the public know. And I think that by doing that, by being transparent, asking the hard questions and letting the public know, what the public has come about is saying, you know, we're kind of okay with the, not okay with the cost overruns or anything like that, but we understand. But we still want the project, and we can get behind it. Because the comments that I get, and I call it my quote-unquote, my supermarket parking lot comments, is that, you know, we just want to believe again. That's what people come up to tell me. We want to be able to believe in this project again. And if we feel that we can have trust in it, or they're not, quote, lying to us, then we can get behind it. And I think that it's been a relatively slow process, but it is public confidence, and it's always been public confidence, because it is an important project for the future, and it's going to be intergenerational. It's not something that people are going to buy in right away, but it is a change in the lifestyle. It's a change in how we look at transportation and how we look at quality of life and how we look at living, because the transit-oriented developments are going to be a key component of it.
You mentioned that, you know, you felt better having seen the polls, and that, you know, people, for whatever reason, either they're simply reconciled to the fact that perhaps it's gone too far to turn back now, or they're feeling better at how it was being regarded or at least looked into, had a lot to do with that watchdog factor. What happens to that in your absence, if you are now often in Washington, and people still want to feel perhaps that they want to believe in this project, and they'd like to believe that government is watching it appropriately, and so especially are those on the HART board?
Well, you know, I have now had the good fortune and the honor of serving with them for slightly over a year. I know people think I've been around a long time, but it's really been a year. And I can tell you, I have very high regard for all of them, and really faith that they will carry on. Because even among the board members, I've seen also you hear more questions being asked, you hear more people interacting, because I think the quote the culture of the board has changed as well, or they have all become a lot more vocal, and I'm sure the public will be served with that, and also City Council is speaking up more. They're putting more oversight, as is the mayor. So I think what you find is that the way HART used to operate, because of the structure of it under the charter, is changing. And hopefully, when the voters go out and vote in November on the charter amendments, and really then entrust the board with the degree of oversight it should have, I believe that you will see the continuation. And if I am off the board, it will be only because I have been successful and I'm in Washington. So it doesn't end. You know, it's to remember the Federal Transit Administration is our partner, and that's the way we got to keep looking at this project and what the full funding grant agreement really means. And they are our partner in this project, and I will be able to participate just wearing a different hat.
As that may happen and the board is still left here, they may be more vocal. They may have been given license to be more vocal. Same thing with the City Council. But the authority issue seems to still be looming out there. What authority do you think that the board needs to have to be able to continue that sense of public trust and confidence that this project will go forward and be appropriately watched?
Well, I think that what a lot of people did not know, and, you know, and I'm probably among that, that when the vote was taken for the creation of the HART in the 2010 election, I don't think people paid attention to this one sentence that said the HART board shall in no way interfere with the administration of HART, basically. That one sentence within the charter is what basically made the board almost irrelevant, except for the hiring and firing and the bonus structure and everything else regarding the executive director. So that is what has to change in this charter amendment. And what the charter amendment does is it just removes that sentence. And what it then does do is it gives the authority to the board to truly have oversight over what's going on, because as it now stands, the board doesn't even approve any of the contracts. I'm not saying they should approve every single one, but it would seem like big transfers, like, for example, from Ansaldo Brava and Ansaldo STS to Hitachi, Rail Italy, that something like that. I believe that the board should weigh in so that the public weighs in, because if we don't weigh in, then the public doesn't get to see it on Olelo, and guess what? It's done basically by the acts of the executive director. So that can't be what people wanted. So those are the things that I think you will see changed, and you can really hold the board accountable. And the board isn't going to be able to tell the public, you know, we're doing what we can do according to how you voted our rights and authorities in the charter.
What about holding Dan Grabauskas accountable? I mean, we've seen the way he acted after the city auditor made comments and tried to, and Dan Grabauskas tried to sort of put a preemptive strike out there. There's been a lot of concern about that from you, from the board. What happens to him? Should he be shaking in his boots a bit?
Well, I'm not one to hedge an answer, as you know, but in this particular situation, Dan is still under evaluation, and it's a personnel matter. So we are actually prohibited by state law from actually discussing it. All I will say is this, that the extension on Dan's evaluation and his negotiations is only to August 21st. So somewhere between now and August 21st, and I haven't heard anything about any further extension, we should have action taken. But that's all that I can say about that.
All right, which means to say we only have a few weeks to find out what will be happening after that, and then we can talk again.
Right, we can, and I look forward to that.
Me too. Thanks very much for the time this morning. Good to talk to you as always.
As always. Thanks, Bethan. Aloha.
Aloha. Former Congresswoman Colleen Hanabusa is the board chairperson of the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation. That may change if she's again elected to Congress this election cycle.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting and Sacred Hearts Academy.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want to do.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Giving to others makes people feel good. So I asked psychiatrist Dr. David Fryer to explain why we feel good when we give. He said, the reward center of the brain is related to the release of a neurotransmitter called dopamine. It's basically a chemical messenger that tells us we feel good about something. Drugs or sensory input can whack it like a sledgehammer. But it can also be stimulated by thoughts. This input can be abstract or refined. For instance, the appreciation of music generates sensory input. Experiences of mastery or achieving a significant goal or belonging to a community or providing philanthropic help are examples of stimulations that are hardwired into us. When we help someone in need, we receive a big release of dopamine, which makes us happy. Not everyone who gives does it to feel good. There are countless reasons for giving, but in the end, people who give usually have a positive feeling about what they've done. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman.
Aloha, I'm Rohini Acharya from UH Manoa. You're tuned to HBR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HIConversation.
And before we leave you for the weekend, we're going to take a look at our email and letters and all the stuff that we've been receiving from you over this last little while. And following yesterday's interview with Hawaii County mayoral candidate Wally Lau, we got this.
Aloha, Beth Ann. I was listening to your interview with Wally Lau earlier and was surprised to hear you characterize the tension concerning agriculture on the Big Island as being between traditional agriculture and anti-GMO activists. Regardless of one's opinions about the merits of anyone's position in this ongoing debate, the debate itself is between anti-GMO activists and organic farmers on the one hand and proponents of GMO crops on the other. There's nothing more traditional than organic farming, which is what agriculture was exclusively since the beginning of agriculture until World War II, and there's nothing less traditional than GMO crops, which didn't exist until 20 years ago. So to associate tradition with GMO proponents and imply that those who differ with their approach are merely anti-GMO activists grossly misinterprets the situation. Paul Achitoff, Honolulu.
And if you follow us on Facebook, you may have noticed that we've been posting the backyard quizzes. We're happy that you enjoy these daily teachable moments. And we heard from Rose Darling from Kahului, who shared this after Tuesday's show. I was tempted to call in, but I already won a t-shirt in June. Great quiz question. Thank you for posting these great backyard quizzes and answers. They help to raise awareness of where we are situated historically, socially, politically, environmentally, geographically, and so forth. Keep it up.
Thanks for the letters. Our talkback line is 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback. At HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Just be sure to put your full name there and also the city from which you are calling or writing. And now, before we have to say goodbye too, we want to make sure you get today's backyard quiz answer.
And today in the quiz, we ask you to name the treaty that established free trade between the U.S. and the Kingdom of Hawaii. The impetus for this early free trade agreement was Americans' lack of access to domestic sugar during the U.S. Civil War. Prior to the Great Mahele, industrial sugar production in Hawaii was limited to small mills drawing from fields of 12 to 50 acres. After 1848, large tracts of land were purchased by Western investors, creating the foundation for Hawaii's sugar plantation system. However, growth was somewhat constrained due to the high costs of U.S. import tariffs and importing industrial equipment and infrastructure. The American Civil War changed all that by eliminating access to sugar produced in the Confederacy, which the Union was blockading. In 3 years, the price of sugar rose 525%. To meet the country's demand for sugar, Congress ratified the Reciprocity Treaty of 1875, which allowed Hawaii to sell sugar to the U.S. without paying import dues or taxes. Fear that this free trade status would be revoked played a large part in American businessmen pushing for the eventual American annexation of Hawaii.
And Wendy Tollison called us from Punchbowl, knew that answer, and we'll get the t-shirt. Again, if you have a quiz question for us, you can always send it in to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, here we are. It's a Friday, and we're going to go home and meet back up here on a Monday morning for another run at the conversation. Meanwhile, what do you take away from today?
Well, all kinds of things. It was kind of interesting to hear about a school that has gone paperless, and you know that's going to happen to a lot of schools in the future.
And you, lover of books that you are, I saw
mixed
you
feelings.
Yes, I could see that on your face, because there's something very different about the experience of having a book in your hand as opposed to reading it online. And even people who have, you know, Kindles and other tablets are saying that too.
Yeah.
Also, good to hear from Colleen Hanabusa. And I know we'll be hearing more as we get to the point where we can actually talk about the review of Dan Grabauskas.
Exactly.
As for today, though, we're going to say goodbye to you and let you know that next week we're going to look at which levels of government affect people's lives the most. UH Associate Professor Morgan Johansson will be here, chair of the Public Administration Program.
And we'll get a preview, live music in the studio with bass virtuoso Ernie Prevention.
As we always tell you, we like to hear from you, and you can call our talkback line whenever the spirit moves and leave us your comments. The number is 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. On Twitter, you can find us at HI Conversation or find me at BKOZHPR, also on Instagram. But you can post your comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
And if you want to hear today's show again, get another past show, our links to more information, look to the Conversation page on the HPR website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Russell Subiono are our production assistants. And today we say goodbye to our great summer intern, Paul Marto Pinto, and wish him good luck.
And our Backyards Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you on Monday for more of The Conversation.